Hello and welcome to Inside Business with Ciarán Hancock, a podcast from the Irish Times. Later in this episode, I'll be talking to Cliff Taylor of the Irish Times and Stephen Kelly of Manufacturing Northern Ireland about the huge surge in north-south border trade since Brexit began at the start of this year. With political tensions rising over the operation of the Northern Ireland Protocol, Stephen Kelly outlines the changes that his members would like to see implemented, while Cliff Taylor gives us his view on the talks between the UK and the European Union to resolve this thorny issue. But first, we're going to look at Fine Gael's ambitious spending plans for the Irish economy, outlined last week by Taoiseach Leo Varadkar at the party's Ardèche. I'm joined for this segment by Cliff Taylor of the Irish Times and Sebastian Barnes, chair of the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council, which has butted heads with the Taoiseach in the past few days over its analysis of government budgetary policy. I'll be asking him about that row later. But I began by asking Cliff Taylor about the spending promises outlined last week by Leo Varadkar. Cliff, can I just ask you, Leo Varadkar was speaking to the Fine Gael Ardèche there last week, and he set out a vision for the future of Ireland as he sees it. He was talking about the need to build 40,000 new homes each year, that the billions in extra health spending that we've seen during COVID, that should continue to be baked into the numbers, and that there should be better pay and terms and conditions for private and public sector workers, and that we should retain the pandemic financial supports for as long as necessary. But all of this comes against the backdrop of likely declining corporation tax revenues due to the global deal that would set a minimum rate of 15% on multinational profits. You've been writing about that a lot recently. And a pledge from the government parties, if you like, not to increase personal taxes. So how do we square that circle?
Good question, Ciarán. And, you know, you might think that the speech was almost like something that would be made in a general election campaign. And of course, we do have a by-election campaign going on at the moment, and you would wonder if that is having some impact on the political statements we're seeing at the moment. But you're right, the Taoiseach did commit to huge amounts of extra spending on housing, on health, and in other areas. And really what the government parties have been saying when they're challenged on this is, oh, growth will take care of it, that the economy is going to bounce back after COVID. Tax receipts are going to rocket, spending is going to fall, and everything will be hunky-dory. And if you look at the stability programme update that the Department of Finance sent to Brussels a few months ago, it did indeed say that borrowing would fall to below 3% of GDP next year and would gradually fizzle out then over the next few years. But the problem is that its forecasts were based on current policies, if you like. And there's no allowance in there for new policies. There's no allowance for all these extra spending commitments that are coming in. There is some allowance made in the figures for falling corporate tax rates, all right. But the big issue is, how are all these additional commitments going to be met? And, you know, bodies such as the Fiscal Advisory Council have also been pointing to longer term pressures in areas like the ageing population and the massive amounts we're going to have to spend on the environmental agenda. So a really big issue there. And I think signs of some tension in government between most of the cabinet on one side and Department of Finance and Public Spending, Pascal Donoghue and Michael McGrath on the other side. And Taoiseach Micheál Martin said this week in the Dáil that Ministers McGrath and Donoghue had given, quotes, a sober assessment to the rest of the cabinet earlier this week on the outlook for the public finances. So it's clear, I think, that the ministers are trying to put the frighteners on their colleagues, you know, that you really need to get real here, that we can't just keep making spending commitments and you know, without looking at how they might be funded. And I think where this is going to come to a head, in the short term anyway, is the summer economic statement, which is promised late this month or early next month, and in which Pascal Donoghue told the Dáil last week he intended to outline some kind of policy for the public finances, what he called an anchor for the public finances. In other words, some kind of target, perhaps for spending, debt, the deficit, which is going to put a limit on things over the next few years. It'll be very interesting to see how he does that and what the rest of his cabinet colleagues are prepared to sign up to.
If you look at the UK, Boris has some big spending plans that he'd like to push through. He likes to go big on things. But, you know, the narrative is that Rishi Sunak is much more sober in his assessment of this, and he's trying to rein in some of those spending promises and is possibly looking at tax increases. Do we know where Pascal stands? Is he on the same page as Leo Varadkar, do you think?
We don't know for sure, but I doubt it. I would suspect, I would guess that he's a little uncomfortable with this. I suppose we do need to remember that we are in an unprecedented situation where spending has had to rocket, as you know, cash from the government has made up from the cash being withdrawn from the private sector to kind of rescue the economy, to bail the economy out over the last couple of years. And that's been essential. It's been very important. And it has, to an extent, been successful in terms of protecting many businesses and many jobs. But it's been clear from the start, I think, that withdrawing that money and kind of nuancing those supports to actually help companies to survive is going to be a much more difficult task than putting it in politically. So we face a very difficult job, I think, of running down the pandemic supports over the next couple of years and seeing where the public finances land. Now, there's no doubt that a takeoff in growth, as most people are forecasting, is going to limit the damage and is going to pay for a lot of this. And I think the way you could look at it is that we might hope that economic growth is going to help us to carry the higher debt levels that we've built up during the pandemic. So the national debt going from 200 billion to the guts of 250 billion after the pandemic. So we could hope to carry that debt forward, and we could hope that interest rates are going to remain low to allow that to happen. But there's a lot of extra spending commitments as well. And I don't think it's realistic to think that we can keep borrowing more and more to pay for extra spending here, there and everywhere without standing back and saying, look, what's that going to mean to borrowing? What's that going to mean for debt? What's that going to mean for our ability to respond if another downturn hits? So I think very difficult decisions facing the government over the next couple of years. Crunch mightn't quite come yet, but I think by the time they get to the October budget, the writing is going to be on the wall in terms of some of the decisions they're going to have to make.
Sebastian Barnes, what's the Fiscal Advisory Council's view on Leo Varadkar's speech and his spending promises, against the backdrop, obviously, where we're going to record a very substantial deficit this year because of COVID, and there are issues around corporation tax revenues going forward, and the fact that, none of the government parties really want to increase income taxes?
So I think Cliff's put it very well there, that even with a strong recovery and low interest rates, things are going to get much better. But we do start from a very big deficit. So we start from an 8% deficit. Now, our assessment is once you factor in those different things, the reduction in corporation tax revenue, the growth, you factor in the cost of delivering current public services, by 2025, you'd probably be somewhere around maybe a small deficit or somewhere around balance. And that's really where we need to get to get debt down from these very high levels that we have now. So debt will still be over 100% of national income at that point. So what that means in kind of concrete terms, and Cliff says very clearly, is that basically there's no space factored into the budget for any additional measures beyond what's already there. So that basically means that any additional measures, so that means more on the housing side or the health side, all of that would have to be paid for somehow. Basically, it would have to be paid through higher taxes, through maybe trying to find some spending elsewhere, but it shouldn't really be paid out of borrowing because debt is still going to be very high at that point and we need to get it back to safer levels. So there's really no space.
What's your view on the pandemic financial supports that are in place? How much longer should we continue to keep them in place? Or how much longer can we afford to keep them in place?
So the affordability, I think, is maybe less of an issue than people have sometimes said. It's obviously a lot of money and it needs to be well spent. But with the current low debt and the fact that this money was really needed to save the economy, I think we've actually been relatively relaxed and supportive about that. But of course, it does need to be wound down. And that will obviously happen as the economy recovers. We expect quite a strong recovery this year. So hopefully it can be wound down fairly quickly. It may be that there are some sectors where the problems are a bit longer lasting, which do need a bit more support, perhaps into next year. Obviously, it depends what happens on the health side. But I think that it's really just a question of how the economy responds and making sure the government supports follow that. And one thing we do see a little bit is the risk that some temporary measures become permanent. And so there was a little bit of discussion of that over the weekend, whether some of the health spending that was done temporarily for COVID should be locked in. You can see in other areas there might be pressures for those to continue. And that would obviously be a different thing from the temporary measures that we've seen so far.
So how do we pay for it, this extra spending that Fine Gael are talking about? You said that we would need to raise additional taxes. How do we go about that? If income taxes aren't going to increase, how do you... Okay, they've announced some increases in property tax, but how do you generate extra tax revenues without hitting income tax to pay for all this?
So I think the government's made it very difficult for itself, because in the programme for government, it basically took half of spending off the table and said it wasn't going to cut that. And then it took a third of taxes, including the income taxes, off the table as well. They talked a little bit about PSRI, but that's only like 13% of the total or something. It's not huge. And even if you look at the kind of, you know, if you have a 1% increase in those taxes, it brings in something like 600, 700 million. It's not a huge amount of money in the scheme of things. So I think it's going to be difficult. I think having the tax commission is a good idea as well. That will hopefully help to, you know, develop a better analysis of maybe where the best areas are. But I think there are limits to it as well. And I think one of the big things over the next year, and actually politicians need to think about this now, is going to be prioritization. It's not going to be possible to do absolutely everything that people want on housing, health, climate. The government's really going to think about which of those things it's going to prioritize, which things it's going to do first, and how much it can do. I mean, we can improve any of these things, which is a good thing, but we obviously can't meet, you know, the full extent of everyone's aspirations, I think, and that's an important message.
The Fiscal Advisory Council and Leo Varadkar have been butting heads over the last few days. I think it's fair to say, Sebastian, he had a bit of a pop at the council, didn't he, recently? We have that clip here. Let's have a listen to it.
I think what the Fiscal Advisory Council has often said is that we underestimate demographics and the cost of that, a growing and ageing population. And that's one of the reasons why I'm saying we need to be honest about the health budget staying big. It's not going to be possible to, and we shouldn't try to reduce it, because we have an ageing and growing population, increasing demands. And I think we should put in our projections the commitments that we've made to index tax bands to make sure that more people don't end up paying that higher rate. We have the fourth highest marginal tax rate in the developed world, and too many people pay that. So I think they're right on that point. But they're not right in everything. You know, bear in mind, this is the same Fiscal Council that told us that we wouldn't balance the budget, and we did it three times. And this is the same Fiscal Council that told us the economy was overheating when actually we were heading into Brexit, a pandemic and a big recession. So we'll take on board their advice, but they are often wrong.
Often wrong, Sebastian Barnes, is what Leo Varadkar says about the Fiscal Advisory Council. What did you think when you heard that?
So actually, there are some things I agree with him about, including aging properly in the projections, also including indexation properly. So there are some areas we agree with. Obviously, when I think the claim that we're often wrong, I think is not right, and we've publicly explained that. You know, we did talk about the risk of overheating before the pandemic. Now, it didn't happen, but that's because we had a global pandemic that no one forecast. But I think that was the right assessment at the time. In terms of the budget balance, not predicting that, we actually, I think our forecasts or the sort of scenarios that we made at the time were actually much more realistic than the ones that the government made. And the reason why we ended up with a budget balance, it was partly actually just because of surprises on the corporation tax side. So I think the council really stands by its assessment. We obviously don't get absolutely everything right, but I think on the whole we've actually got a very good track record. And I think, you know, one of the jobs of the council is to sometimes say hard truths to politicians and to the public, and to say we actually face some quite hard choices on the public finances. So we're not always going to be very popular with politicians, but I think the council will continue to say to give our assessment in the most objective, thorough, and honest way that we can. And I think that's our role in the system, whether other people agree with us or not.
Nonetheless, a bit unedifying, isn't it, to have this kind of spat, if you like, between a senior government minister and the state's fiscal watchdog. I mean, I presume the Fiscal Advisory Council is funded by the government, is it?
Yes. So the Fiscal Advisory Council is set up by the government under the Fiscal Responsibility Act. It's paid for by the government. Its budget is actually protected from day-to-day political interference. And this is probably perhaps a reminder of why something like that is important. And I don't think it's particularly helpful for, and people can obviously disagree with the council, but I don't think it's particularly helpful for people to undermine its credibility, particularly when there, you know, isn't a good reason to do that. And I think we're trying to provide a good service to the political system and to the people of Ireland in terms of having this objective assessment of the public finances. I think we've done a lot to help people's understanding of the issues and the choices that we face. And as I said, that won't always make us flavour of the month. We're an independent body, and we will continue to speak truth onto power as best we can.
Do you feel that Leo Varadkar's comments undermine the credibility of the council?
To be honest, I don't think so. I think the credibility of the council really depends on the work that we do, on the fact that we speak the truth, and the fact that we do a lot of analysis. I think the quality of analysis of fiscal policy in Ireland has got much better. I think the debate has got much better. The fact we're having this discussion here, and I think there's a wide understanding in the political system and in the public and amongst journalists of the choices we face for the years ahead, of the fact the government hasn't really set out a program for the medium term. There's no real medium term plan, and that creates risks. And I think the fact there's an understanding of that, it is related to the work of the council. So I don't think it really undermines its credibility. I don't think it's a big issue.
And Sebastian, as chairman, I mean, do you meet the politicians regularly? Do you meet the Minister for Finance, Pascal Donohue, or have you met Leo Varadkar or the Taoiseach even?
One of the important things of our work is our independence, and we also believe very strongly in transparency and also avoiding groupthink. So we want to be a little bit outside the system. And so we actually don't meet with politicians. All of our advice we basically give in public. So you can go on our website and you can read our reports. And that's exactly what we're saying. We also appear before the Oireachtas Committee. And again, you can see that's all available publicly as well. So we don't have these interactions because this independence is very important.
And on the outside looking in, Sebastian, some people might wonder about the Fiscal Advisory Council's role, because there have been criticisms of budgetary policy by yourself and by your predecessor, Seamus Coffey. The government just seems to shrug and doesn't really seem to engage with that advice, if you like, or those observations in a meaningful way. So some people might ask the question about what's the point of it all?
I think the council does have a big impact, actually. I think the council, a lot of the time our views haven't been that different from the government. So, whether that's because the government's been following us or not, I don't know. There have been a couple of occasions, actually, in the budget 2 years ago, where the ministers have explicitly said that they have done something differently purely on the advice of the council. So I think, there are these very concrete examples. But I think, they have taken on board a lot of our advice, often on technical things or things that maybe don't feature in everyday discussion, but are actually quite important. And I think there are areas, again, where they haven't followed our advice. We're only an advisory body. We try and persuade people, the public, politicians, of our position. I think there are a lot of people who've come around to our way of thinking on a number of issues. The government hasn't always done that, and I guess it's up to them whether they, I guess they have reasons for not doing that. But I think we have delivered the right advice. And actually, I think they would do well to listen to it. I mean, particularly on this medium term planning issue, the government is taking a big risk. It's making commitments. Last year in the budget, it committed to a sort of 5 to 8 billion increase in permanent spending, which is absolutely huge. I don't think anyone would really have noticed that had the council not pointed that out. I think that's a mistake. That was something, and we said that wasn't appropriate. That's one of the reasons why things are so tight in the years ahead is that usually growth does pay for quite a lot of increase in public spending. But here it was actually all spent last year. And so we've got a few years where we just have to wait until the kind of economy catches up. And so I think the council's advice does have an influence. As I said, it's not perfect. And I guess the government should be held to account if people don't like what it's done and it's against the council's advice.
Cliff Taylor, were you surprised by Leo Varadkar's comments?
A little, Kieran, I suppose, all right. But he does tend to be pointed in his comments. And to be honest with you, it's probably a good thing if the Fiscal Council is getting under the skin of politicians a bit, because I think that's what it's paid to do. It's paid to kind of speak out, to kind of irritate politicians a bit, to point out things that they probably don't want to be pointed out. And I think, Sebastian's right that the council has had a significant impact on the debate here in recent years and probably on the course of fiscal policy in terms of what was done before the pandemic, which, credit to the government and credit to the council, I think has left us in a reasonable position coming into the pandemic. But the key point, I think, that it's making now is correct, that we just feel a bit, the whole thing just feels a bit loose and untethered at the moment. We've no kind of framework looking at over the next few years. In the stability programme update, the government, just basically said, well, if we don't do anything else, here's the way the finances might pan out. But that's not realistic. What we need to start moving towards is what is planned to be done? How's it going to be paid for? What's that going to mean for the public finances and the national debt? Some kind of framework for decisions. And if you don't have a framework, then you're just going to have politicians coming out and promising to increase spending and cut taxes. Because there's no way to kind of call it to account. There's no way to say, look, what will that mean for borrowing next year or the deficit the year after or whatever. So I think it is important that that is developed. And I think there's as I said at the start, I think there's a bit of a struggle going on in the government at the moment about that. Politically, there's a huge push to spend more. Politically, the government is seeing, you know, rising support for Sinn Féin, which is in turn supporting increased spending in a whole lot of different areas. And I guess that is the trend worldwide to some extent as well. But big questions about, you know, what that means for the public finances over the next few years. We are so lucky that interest rates remain on the floor and are on the floor and are likely to remain there. And it will hopefully give us the flexibility to get out of this in reasonable shape. And I guess the good news from the council's analysis over the last year or so is that we can get out of this without a return to the kind of austerity we saw after the last crisis. We may need to trim our sails. We may need to raise more money, but that's not the same as austerity. Austerity is cutting back in the face of a recession, and we should hopefully be able to avoid that this time around.
Okay, let's hope so. We leave it there. Sebastian Barnes of the Fiscal Advisory Council, thank you for joining us. Now, I'm delighted to be joined on the line by Stephen Kelly, Chief Executive of Manufacturing Northern Ireland. Cliff, you might start with you. We had data from the CSO last week showing that there'd been a major upturn in the level of cross-border trade in the first 4 months of this year, suggests that more and more companies are using the border to bypass customs checks post-Brexit. The value of goods import from the north rose by 60% to just over €1 billion in the period, while the value of exports from the Republic to the north rose by 40% to just under €1 billion. So, wondering if you can interpret that for us and tell us why we're seeing such big uplifts in trade north and south.
Yeah, early days yet, I suppose, after the UK actually left the customs union and single market, and Brexit economically happened. But I guess what we've seen is a pretty extraordinary economic adjustment in the meantime, as you said. The latest figure showing imports up 60% from Northern Ireland, exports to Northern Ireland up 40%, and also a big fall off in Irish imports from the UK. So as you say, there's obviously a bit of diversion in trade going on. The CSO have guided that some British companies are using Northern Ireland to bring goods from Britain to the Republic through the north, as they find that easier now with the new customs rules. So there's a lot of settling down to do. There was also a lot of stockpiling before the end of last year by companies because they were afraid about how the new rules would operate. Companies are also getting used to the rules in terms of importing from the UK into the Republic and also from Britain into the north. So there's a lot of different parts and a lot of settling down going on. But I think there's enough to say that there's clear evidence that trade patterns are changing. And I mean, one thing looking at the Republic, for example, is the extraordinary change in freight movements with a load of new direct boat routes from Ireland to continental Europe, and a much smaller amount of goods using the land bridge. Still a very significant amount, but much less than would have been the case in the past. So a very sharp initial adjustment. Still, I think, a lot of noise in the data, and we'll have to see how it settles down. But it does seem to have given a boost to north-south trade. It does seem to have hit trade between Ireland and Britain. We don't have any data on trade between Great Britain and the North. That's only published, I think, once a year. But obviously, we know there have been some problems and some difficulties there, particularly in relation to the importation of food and agricultural products from Britain into the North, and also more generally as well.
Stephen Kelly, I think your organisation has about 5,500 members in the North. What are they seeing on the ground? What are they telling you?
Well, clearly, one of the outcomes of Brexit and the protocol was that Northern Irish goods can continue to freely circulate to the EU. And in general, our members are reporting that that's working well. There are issues, there are concerns, there are blips in certain member states. There are frictions appearing as other member states and their agencies don't differentiate between the UK and Northern Ireland, so they don't recognise that our goods can freely circulate. But that's not the case on the island of Ireland. What manufacturers are saying is that more than half have seen no impact whatsoever from the 1st of January this year, and about 10% are reporting that there's quite a significant uptick in terms of their trade on the island of Ireland. So the one half of the Brexit deal, the EU half, in terms of ensuring goods can freely circulate, seems to be working reasonably well.
Okay, and what are the reasons for such large increases in your opinion? I mean, 60% in terms of goods coming from the north-south and 40% in terms of from the Republic to the north. Huge numbers.
They are, and I mean, I'm no trade expert, but what I can say is that business will always find the easiest route. In many ways, I suppose trade is like water. It will flow and find where the barriers are and try to divert themselves around those. And clearly, there's a full third country international border between Britain and Ireland. Dublin Port is the equivalent of Calais or Rotterdam or any of these other European ports. And actually having to do a full frontier declaration from Britain into Ireland is a bit of a pain for businesses. So when they look at ways and easier routes for that trade to flow, they don't need to look too far where there's people just up the road that can supply them. We haven't got into the numbers that they're reported, but my understanding is that there's a lot of stuff in and around grain, a lot of stuff in and around perhaps flour and those sort of issues. So those kind of staple items that Irish consumers need or farmers need, they're certainly looking north for those items because it's just too difficult to land those from Britain into Dublin Port, for instance.
What about the Irish Sea border? As we know it, the Northern Ireland Protocol means that goods coming in from Britain to the north have to go through customs checks now. How's that working, Stephen?
It's fair to say that it's been a difficult experience. The process actually works in two stages. So Cliff referenced earlier that some Irish businesses are perhaps using northern ports to bring goods into the Republic of Ireland. The way the process works is that there's a simplified frontier declaration just to allow goods to move first. And then that's followed up by what's called a supplementary declaration, which is by 23 separate data fields, including the value, the weight, the origin, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So in the end, all businesses in the north will still have to complete the same full frontier declaration as businesses in the south and using Dublin Port, for instance, would have to do. And it's clear that from all the survey work that we've been doing and even talking to others in other sectors, GB businesses have been completely unprepared for what was coming on the 1st of January. And in fact, 6 months into this process, they remain unprepared. Now, the worry for us is that despite all the effort that we have thrown in terms of business with our suppliers, despite all the effort and indeed the money that the UK government has thrown at GB suppliers to Northern Ireland, that dial really hasn't moved at all this year. Half of all manufacturers are reporting that their biggest challenge remains that GB suppliers are unprepared to send stuff to Northern Ireland. But more worryingly, Ciarán, is that when we asked the sector back in February, whether their suppliers were committed to continuing to send goods to Northern Ireland, that was about 15%, but that's now jumped to roughly about 20%. So one in five manufacturers are reporting that GB suppliers to their business that may have gone back for decades are now unprepared to send goods to Northern Ireland. And the reason for that is plain and simple, that their suppliers are not willing to engage in the customs formalities that are required to send goods to Northern Ireland. They're not willing to engage because they don't have the knowledge or experience, but also the cost of this. This is adding significantly to the cost of sending goods to Northern Ireland. That's reflected in the performance and the behaviour now of GB suppliers who are just cutting Northern Ireland out of their supply chain completely.
How has it come to this pass, Stephen? Because, you know, Boris Johnson and the Conservatives promised a very simple Brexit trade deal and one that would be good for the whole of the UK. So how has it come to this pass that manufacturers in the north are having these issues with suppliers in GB?
There's a very famous video going around social media that I shared, which was Boris Johnson speaking at an event in Northern Ireland, where he promised that if anybody was asked for any of the paperwork, to just crumple it up and put it in the bin, or to ring number 10 and ask for him personally. Now, we haven't had the opportunity to ring him personally yet, but to be fair to the Prime Minister, what he was talking about was the unfettered access that Northern Ireland businesses will continue to have and do continue to have with the rest of the United Kingdom. Our businesses are reporting that they are sending stuff with ease from Northern Ireland to GB. In fact, demand is pretty high at the moment, and the challenge is getting trailers back so that we can actually send stuff back across again. There's been a flip there in terms of the amount of goods that we bring into Northern Ireland is now less than what we send from Northern Ireland to GB. And that in itself is causing issues. I mean, the big problem for us in the middle of all of this is that the trade deal that the UK and the EU concluded is a very weak agreement. It comes with very significant problems, particularly for those that need components or ingredients or raw materials that would ordinarily be distributed from Great Britain. The rules of origin are next to non-existent, and that's created massive issues for our manufacturers in terms of continuing their supply chains. If we were asking for one particular change to happen within the TCA that the UK and the EU have agreed, it's actually to allow goods that are distributed from Great Britain that are EU origin. So we accept the fact that Chinese origin goods are a risk, but EU origin goods are actually arriving in Britain on their route to Northern Ireland, and we're not receiving the benefit of the TCA like other nations would have. So that principle of goods being at risk of working their way into the EU's single market, we don't think there's any risk of EU goods simply distributed from Britain working their way back into the EU's own market. We don't believe that causes any significant challenge to the European Union single market itself. So, yeah, we have issues, we have problems, but we also see big opportunities here, Ciarán, and perhaps we'll get into that later on in the conversation.
Yeah, so just to be clear, goods going from Britain to Northern Ireland, there are issues there because they have to go through various customs checks, but goods going from Northern Ireland to Britain are basically sailing through the ports unfettered.
Yeah, no challenges, no issues there at all. The only issue is the availability of trailers. We're making so much stuff and sending so much stuff to Great Britain as their market begins to open up that we just are struggling with the transport links rather than anything else.
Cliff, the Northern Ireland Protocol has become a hot political issue, hasn't it? Not just in Northern Ireland among unionists, but also between the EU and the UK. It's a real point of friction at the minute. Where are we at with that?
Well, I was reading the evidence to the Northern Ireland Affairs Committee over the last few days, which has been discussing the protocol. And where we're at is that the EU and the UK are trying to come up with fixes and solutions to make things flow a bit easier. But it's difficult to know the extent of the UK government's involvement in that, if you like. Brandon Lewis was on again today at the Northern Ireland Affairs Committee saying, look, the protocol as it works is not sustainable, you know, has to change fundamentally. On the other hand, there were a variety of business groups like Stevens appearing before the committee, talking about the kind of practical fixes that might be done in areas like, as he said, the rules of origin requirements, which traders are finding kind of difficult to work. And the food area, where kind of an SPS veterinary deal between the UK and the EU would remove the need for a lot of checks on goods moving from Britain to Northern Ireland and would make things a lot easier. So I think we're at a difficult point where it's not clear if those kind of easing and making the deal work better are going to do it politically in the North, or whether the DUP and the British government to some extent are going to hold out against the protocol and lead to, you know, what could be a very difficult political situation.
Yeah, how has it come to this pass? I mean, it's only about 6 months ago that this deal was signed, 7 months ago that this deal was signed. So, I mean, how have we come to this pass so quickly? How come these things weren't anticipated?
Well, they were. I think what you could say is the British government, you know, signed up to something. Did they realise what it meant? I'm sure they did. I'm sure the senior civil servants in London, you know, realised exactly what was meant. And I think we've seen two problems since then. One is that this deal was done at the last minute and a lot of the I's weren't dotted and T's weren't crossed. And there was a huge lack of consultation with business about how this would work in practice. So there's a lot of settling down to be done and a lot of kind of nuances to be sorted out. But there is also the fundamental question and the political question that you have a border there. No matter what's done, you have some kind of border there in the Irish Sea. And I think the big political issue now going forward is whether enough can be done to make the protocol work smoothly, that, you know, that the bigger political issue is solved. From what the DUP and the British government are saying at the moment, you would think no is the answer to that. But, you know, are they just position taking? Are they just putting pressure on the EU to give a bit in the negotiations? It's unclear. But an easy solution is, you know, isn't evident. A lot of practical things that can be done to make things easier. But the political point remains that, you know, there will be some kind of a trade border in the Irish Sea. And as of now, the DUP and the other unionist parties are saying that's a no-go for them.
Yeah, and Micheál Martin calling for some flexibility among his fellow EU leaders.
Yeah, I mean, there are things that the EU can do. As Stephen said, there's a lot of debate about goods that would be classified as being at risk of moving into the EU single market and how they should be treated. Suggestions before the Northern Ireland Affairs Committee that a lot more goods at the Northern Ireland port could be effectively green-lighted and not seen to be at risk and could move through quick channels without having to go through all these checks. Suggestions that the bureaucracy could be made a lot easier and that the rules of origin rules could be clarified. And all those kind of things that, you know, might have been done over time in a normal trade deal over years as it was negotiated. But because this thing was, you know, pulled together at the last minute as a way forward, just weren't done. You know, so let's hope that some progress can be made. And the EU will surely show some flexibility. But the clear signs also are that, you know, looking at what happened at the G7 meeting and other contacts recently, that they're pretty fed up with the UK government at the moment. They don't feel they're dealing straight on this. They don't feel they're keeping to the arrangement that they signed when the deal was done. And it remains to be seen in that context what flexibility they will show.
Stephen, on the face of it, manufacturers in Northern Ireland, you might think they have the best of both worlds. I mean, access to the EU's single market and also access to the British consumer market. It sounds like a pretty good outcome for manufacturers post-Brexit.
Yeah, it does, Ciarán. I mean, the reality is slightly different than what's painted there. I suppose, just kind of going back to Cliff's kind of comments earlier there, that I mean, the reality for many businesses in the North is that this is a system and a process that was introduced at pace. And you'll understand this as journalists. You can't just sit down and write your 500, 1,000 words and get it right first time. Sometimes you have to go back to it and sometimes you have to edit it and change it and nuance it a little bit more. And that's exactly the same in terms of the operation of the protocol. On paper, it looks like it works fine. But in practice, it comes with very significant problems, that some of which were quite clearly articulated by business and others since the UK and the EU did this deal back in 2019. But some of them are just emerging as well. And certainly in our conversations with the UK government, but also with the European Union, we're identifying where those things aren't working as well as what they anticipated to be. We're asking them to say, listen, we've got to 80% as quickly as we possibly can. It's going to take time to get to the other 20%. That's going to need some flexibility on your behalf, and it's going to need some workarounds on our behalf. And if we're able to do that, if we're able to resolve some of the problems that were not visible whenever these deals were done, then we are potentially on an opportunity here. And certainly the headline of having the best of both worlds is one which is very attractive to investors. Our investment agency, Invest Northern Ireland, have had more inquiries in the first 3 months of this year than they had in any whole year over the last 5 years. We've already talked about the increase in trade from Northern Ireland to Ireland since the 1st of January. And our members are shouting at the Northern Ireland executive. Half of them are saying, listen, grasp the opportunities that are being presented. Go and find the markets for us. Go out to the market and tell investors, actually, Northern Ireland has such a unique position. You need to come and look at us. And to create that kind of wealth and work that we all crave, that we know at the end will cement the peace process in itself. And I think the challenge that we have at the moment between the relationship between the UK and the EU is that they're speaking different languages. The EU is speaking binary, that old code of ones and zeros, but the UK is speaking poetry. And stuck in the middle is business who are speaking reality. And somewhere between all of that, hopefully they land where we are, rather than where either side are. But if we do that, I think we're in certainly a unique position that will allow Northern Ireland to prosper.
So if there was one thing you would say to the UK and EU that they could do that might help grease the wheels in this situation, that might make life better for manufacturers in Northern Ireland, what would it be?
It's actually four things, Ciarán. Typical Northern Ireland. You offer us two and we'll take four. But for us, it is the need for stability. So to sort out and decompress some of the politics that are witnessing here. I know you and your colleagues will know that the number one priority for business and investors is political stability, but we just don't have that right now. And that's the reality that we face. So we need some political stability, and that comes with actually buying some more time in terms of getting some of these systems and processes up and running and ready. The second thing is certainty. So what are the long-term solutions? And those need to be designed with business. Cliff absolutely correct earlier when he said, a lot of this stuff was done late and wasn't done in consultation with business. But business are the only people who will have to deliver the protocol. And we will be the people that will make it work. So talk to us. We've provided a 12-page paper now to the UK and the EU about ideas about how to actually make that work. The third thing is simplicity. And the reality for us is that all the systems that are in place are for shipping a full 40-foot container of a single commodity from somewhere in the world into a large port. But what happens between Britain and Northern Ireland is, if you take a supermarket, for instance, there could be 2,000 separate items on there. And it's just not practical for business to be able to operate on that basis. So we need a huge piece of work done in terms of making this more simplified. And then the last piece is affordability. And the UK government has stepped in to a degree in this. They've spent £355 million on what's called the Trader Support Service, and there's other investments as well. But all of this is coming at a cost. And at this point in time, just like the rest of Ireland, we have all the costs of Brexit, but we have the additional costs associated with the protocol. So we need to make sure that both businesses and households have an outcome here which is affordable, and an outcome that ensures that our prosperity can be guaranteed. So for us, it is that stability, certainty, simplicity and affordability. If we've got those things and we have ideas and we've shared them with both sides, then I think that we can actually grasp that opportunity that's presented to us.
And is there a concern, Stephen, that the Stormont Executive might collapse? There's a lot of political flux, obviously, in the North at the minute. The DUP is on its, third leader in a matter of weeks now. And tensions there around the Northern Ireland Protocol, very evident tensions.
Yeah, there is a concern. I mean, for us, why did business get involved in this whole process? It was back in 2017, the executive fell and business found itself with no voice, so it had no choice and it had to step into this space. And now we're here, we're not exiting it. We are being asked to deliver on the protocol. So if we're being asked to deliver, then we need to be listened to in terms of the issues that's been created, but also the opportunities to make those issues disappear. If the executive falls, business will still be here. Civic society will still be around. We'll still be engaging with the UK government and the EU. However, that's not as strong as actually our democratically elected representatives actually making the case on our behalf. It is an ugly system of government in many respects, but it's our system of government and we love it, just like we would love our own children. And we want to make sure that this actually works on behalf of not just business, but every citizen in Northern Ireland. So there is a warning there for the UK and the EU that they need to resolve these issues and resolve them quickly. The summer period is always very difficult in the North. It will be even more difficult, I believe, this year, given the pressure that's on our political class. So the EU and the UK need to respond to that. And we would hope that they would meet prior to the marching season and agree some of those requests that the UK have made in terms of the extension of grace periods for prohibited and restricted items, and create space to allow business to work with government to show something that can actually work in practice and not just work on paper.
Cliff, it's the fifth anniversary of the Brexit vote. I know the British government, the Conservatives at the minute are saying it's been a success, and Boris Johnson has outlined his reasons for that, a whole pile of them, and Priti Patel as well. What's your view on Brexit 5 years on?
Yeah, it's been all cost for the UK, hasn't it, Kieran? It's very hard to see where the economic advantage is for the UK.
But they just signed a trade deal with Australia.
Small beans, really. I mean, the key thing in trade is the big trade is with the countries that you're close to. And Australia is a long, long way away. And these big trade, well, very significant trade barriers now exist between the UK and its nearest market, the EU. And I think one of the things, you know, as Stephen referred to, is that despite the talk of the trade deal between the UK and the EU, what we are seeing now is that being in a trade deal versus being in the single market are two very different things. And the UK is slowly, I think, starting to wake up to the cost of losing that frictionless unbureaucratic access to the massive market on its front door, if you like. And you know, no deals that are done with Australia or New Zealand or even the US are going to make up for that in any way. Brexit economically was always about damage limitation, and the damage, I think, is over the long term is going to be pretty significant.
And the damage for the Republic, economically?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. There's certainly damage to trade between Ireland and the UK in the long term, I think, or Ireland and Britain anyway, in the long term. There are, you know, thousands of decisions, as Stephen was saying, you know, water flows to the easiest point, and thousands of small decisions are now being taken in a different context than it would have been in the past. And you know, some things will cost more to do. And one of the things that was interesting, looking at the evidence of the Northern Ireland Affairs Committee, were businesses in the north saying, look, we've taken the cost so far, but a time is going to come when we're going to have to pass this on to our, you know, consumers, whether they be other businesses or whether they be people buying in the shops. You know, and you'd have to think that, you know, that's going to be one of the factors here. You know, we are going to see prices going up. We are going to see less efficient trade because, you know, a barrier has gone up with our nearest and one of our biggest markets. So, you know, it costs to us a slower, kind of longer term cost. And hopefully one that we can get around by, you know, building in other markets post-pandemic in the EU and further overseas. You know, we've shown huge, the Republic's economy has shown huge, the huge ability to do that. Certainly in the multinational sector, I guess where the damage of Brexit shows is more in the domestic sector for Ireland.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Stephen Kelly of Manufacturing Northern Ireland and Cliff Taylor of the Irish Times, thank you for joining us. Okay, that's it for this week from Inside Business. My thanks to Cliff Taylor, Stephen Kelly and Sebastian Barnes. Suzanne Brennan produced the show with JJ Vernon on sound. Remember, you can get the latest business news straight into your inbox by signing up to our Business Today email at irishtimes.com. And you can also follow the Irish Times business feed on Twitter, LinkedIn and Facebook each day. I'm Ciarán Hancock. Until next time, take care.